Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts is ready to start distributing the coronavirus vaccine in a matter of days. That is the headline from a blockbuster news conference this afternoon where Governor Charlie Baker explained the final priorities in who can get the vaccine and when. Baker says the first doses will go to hospitals and people fighting the pandemic.
Our plan for the first round of vaccine shipments maximizes life-saving care for our most vulnerable residents and protects healthcare workers, first responders, and workers doing COVID-facing work so our healthcare system can continue to treat patients.
WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown was at the governor's press conference. He joins us now. Steve, always good to talk to you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to talk with you, Tiziana.
So let's give our listeners brass tacks to start. Who is in the first round of receiving the vaccines?
Yeah, among those in phase one, which will be running from as soon as the FDA approves the vaccine until February, will be clinical and non-clinical healthcare workers who are doing direct and COVID-facing care. Also, residents of long-term care facilities, think rest homes and assisted living facilities, police, fire, and EMS personnel. Also, folks living in congregate care settings, think prisons and houses of correction, and also homeless shelters. Home-based health care workers, those are visiting nurses and home health aides who care for the sick and elderly in their own homes. And finally, other health care workers who are doing non-COVID-facing care.
And I guess we should clarify, Steve, that's the list in phase one. But that order that you just gave us is also an order of priority within phase one, correct?
That's right. They have them, so the doctors and nurses and healthcare people, people working in healthcare, they're going to be the top of that list in phase one. And then they kind of just, as I had listed them, go down.
Work their way down.
In that order, yeah.
Okay, so millions of people live in Massachusetts. How many are going to be vaccinated in this first phase?
First phase, 300,000 people or so are in the first group. That breaks down roughly 165,000 for healthcare workers, 50,000 or so for police, fire, and EMS, and 100,000 folks in long-term care facilities.
So I'm looking at this handy chart that the governor put out today. There are two other phases. Can you take people through those?
Sure. Phase two, which is expected to run from February through April, includes about 1.9 million people. Those groups will include people with two or more comorbidities, K through 12 educators and staff, transit workers, grocery workers, agriculture workers, sanitation, public works, and public health workers, also people over the age of 65. And then at the end of phase two, people with one comorbidity. Now, phase three, which they estimate will begin around April, is for everybody else.
So I know the state had to submit a plan to the CDC by the end of the week last week. How did they come up with this list? How did they decide who was in phase one, phase two, et cetera?
Yeah, the state put together a vaccine advisory task force to set the priorities. Now, obviously, those on the front line in healthcare need to be at the top of the list. It's kind of a no-brainer since they are the group that's coming in contact with people who are sick. Also, after seeing how this virus ran roughshod through the nursing homes, they want to protect the most vulnerable of those folks. Plus, for them, there's an ease of distribution. A volunteer pharmacist and technician will show up at a nursing home with all the vaccine that they need and just inoculate all the residents in a rather short period of time. It's one-stop shopping, so to speak. The same goes for those in congregate care.
And how will people in congregate care, Steve, like shelters, incarceration, how will they get it?
Yeah, so as far as the long-term care facilities, Walgreens and CVS have been contracted to go out and provide the vaccinations on location. Now, they may also do it for shelters. Not sure exactly who will be dispensing it in the prisons as security is a concern. They may train the DOC medical contractors to administer the vaccine. I'm sure the particulars of those details are still being worked out.
And to clarify, this is all pending approval of the vaccine, right?
Yeah, everyone seems to say that approval is imminent. Of course, the British counterpart of the FDA approved the Pfizer vaccine last week, and the first shots were given out in England earlier this week. No one at today's news conference seems to be concerned that the FDA approval might not come.
So we have about a minute left, Steve. I was struck by a question you asked the governor. You asked him if he'd talked to his father about the vaccine and if he had any concerns about being among the first to take it. He was a little caught off guard. Here he is.
Wasn't expecting that. I don't have any problems with it at all. Obviously, he's a big boy, and he'll make whatever decision he makes he thinks is in his best interest. But I would certainly recommend to him that he get vaccinated.
Just briefly, Steve, why'd you ask him the question, and what did you make of his answer?
Well, we're all asking the same question. Do I want my loved one to take this vaccine? So I knew for him this was going to be personal. It wasn't just, you know, a list of people. It's his dad. And so I knew that would cut to the chase. Is he confident in this vaccine? And due to his answer, I think he is.
That is WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown. Steve, thanks.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Six categories of healthcare workers and at-risk communities qualify for the coronavirus vaccine in Massachusetts in phase one, and that phase starts this month. Governor Charlie Baker outlined the state's vaccine distribution plan at a press conference today and projects that the vaccine would be available to the general public as early as April. Here he is this afternoon.
The availability of a COVID-19 vaccine obviously provides much needed hope and relief for many. In some ways, it does represent the so-called light at the end of the tunnel.
So let's dig further into the what and the why of this distribution plan now with Dr. Helen Boucher, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center and a professor at the Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher who focuses on vaccines and the epidemiology of respiratory diseases. He's also an associate professor at the BU School of Public Health. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Great to
Thanks
be here.
Thanks so much.
So, Dr. Boucher, was this the set of rollout priorities that you expected?
You know, Tiziana, it really is what we expected based on the advice from the CDC's advisory committee last week, very much in line with focusing on frontline health workers and then getting to patients most at risk.
And Dr. Gill, same for you, or were there any surprises or variances from what you thought you'd see?
No, not at all. This is what I was expecting to see also.
And let me ask the two of you about that, because we have seen at times during this pandemic better alignment with sort of federal guidelines, federal government leading first, but then also times when the state was leading first. It does seem with this distribution, however, that states, including Massachusetts, are going to kind of hew closely to what the CDC is saying. Is that accurate?
You know, I think so, based on what we know now, Tiziana. Tomorrow is an important day. The FDA Advisory Committee is being convened to review the data on the Pfizer vaccine, and we'll see perhaps an action from the FDA in the next, 24, 48 hours. The CDC group will meet again to make their final recommendations. So, it's still possible that things change a little bit, but so far it looks like there's good alignment.
Dr. Gill, there were choices that had to be made, especially between, let's say, phase one and phase two. If one can see the chart, there are all of these various vulnerable groups in phase one and phase two, and then phase three has one line that says vaccine available to general public. So obviously the tough choices are in those first two phases. How do we figure out what kind of criteria do healthcare providers and public health professionals use to figure out where that dividing line is?
It's a very complicated question you're asking. and I guess the answer is somewhat subjective, but we're first looking at, the risk of being exposed. And so when we prioritize the frontline workers and the police and the fire department and the people who are, as they're calling it, COVID facing, what we're really saying is that, these are individuals who have been putting themselves at risk for the general benefit of the rest of us, which is really extraordinary if you think about it. And I think there is a definite sense of justice in my mind that we are now prioritizing the sacrifice that they made for us to protect them first in turn. I think this is absolutely morally the right thing to do. And then when we move beyond that, we're looking at different categories in terms of the consequences of exposure as opposed to the probability of exposures. We're looking at different groups who are you know, to varying degrees, more or less likely to suffer harm, you know, in terms of very severe disease or possibly death, if they were to be exposed with COVID-19. So that's sort of how we're viewing that. I think the first is sort of a pragmatic and I think morally appropriate way of triaging, and the second is really sort of focusing on who in our society is most likely to be harmed by this terrible disease.
So Dr. Boucher, building on what Dr. Gill just said, I want to dive a little deeply into one particular population. Last week, we had Dr. Paul Bittinger, who's the head of the COVID-19 advisory group, on the air, and he told us that that group had recommended that those in incarceration qualify for phase one. In fact, they did. And you may know that the incarcerated have been particularly vulnerable to the spread of the virus, and that testing and care have arguably come late to our jails and prisons. Was this an important public health move, and does it put this vulnerable population in the right place?
Yeah, well, I think you hit on a very important aspect of this whole sort of process at the state level, and the governor was very clear about this today, that the task force approached this whole process with a lens of equity and justice, and so focusing on people in congregate settings like shelters and correctional facilities is very important for that reason, as well as a public health reason, right? The spread has been really out of control in those settings. So from a public health perspective, it's absolutely indicated. But from an equity and justice perspective, those people have less of a voice. And so just like we're focusing on the environmental services worker and the food service worker in the hospital as healthcare providers, we're focusing on these folks as people at great risk with perhaps not the voice they should have.
So let's talk about the timeline, and I've referred to this simple chart that the governor put out today a couple of times. We will link to this chart on our website, radioboston.org, so that listeners will be able to look at it too. Phase one is December through February, phase two, February through April, phase three, which is general population, April through June. Dr. Gill, that's both encouraging, and I wonder if it's overly optimistic. Can we hit those marks?
To tell the truth, I don't know. Because I don't know exactly how the doses that are going to be manufactured by Pfizer and one assumes Moderna shortly thereafter are going to be distributed across the country, or even whether some of them are going to be used ex-US. So I don't have a sense as to what the numbers of doses that are being allocated on a state-by-state basis will be. And obviously that's very important. And you know, then the second question is also not just the numbers of doses that can be delivered, but our capacity to absorb them in terms of vaccine distribution and also managing the sort of complicated cold chain that particularly the Pfizer vaccine faces. So I guess I can't give you a good, keeping it not just cold, but like super cold. So that is an element to vaccine distribution that we've never really encountered before. So I'm as curious as you are to see how this will play out.
So Dr. Boucher, there's the complications that Dr. Gill was talking about with managing, I think the phrase you used, Dr. Gill, was the cold chain. I'm also mindful that both Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines, the first two that we expect to be approved for emergency use, require people to get a shot twice. And that essentially doubles the administration and the compliance for a single person to be vaccinated. Does that put a schedule at risk too? Does that double how hard this is to do?
Well, it certainly adds another layer of complexity, Tiziana. And I think that as our teams are working hard to gear up for this process, you know, we're thinking about things like text reminders and other ways we can remind folks that they need to come back on that day 21 for the Pfizer vaccine or day 28 for the Moderna, assuming they both come to be available. And it is going to add to the work, and we're going to have to learn how to do this efficiently. And I think there's huge commitment to do it. But as Dr. Gill pointed out, this is not something that we have done any time in our recent history.
Dr. Gill, we've talked about the complexities here. Is there any advice that you, who have worked on vaccines in the past, would give to the Commonwealth as it prepares to start distribution?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to understand is that we're approaching the distribution of any new vaccine as sort of a public health strategy rather than an attempt to sort of deliver a product to individuals. So we have to think about, like, what are we trying to do at a population level? And so that's where these early decisions about who goes first and the high-risk groups and the phase one and phase two and phase three rollout plans become so important. And so, you know, there's been a lot of discussion, for example, about how do we achieve this threshold of herd immunity, which is, you know, estimated to be around 60 or 70% of the population who would need to be immune, not just vaccinated, but immune, to shut down transmission of COVID-19 completely. And so when we think about that, you know, with the relatively small numbers of doses that we're giving now, we're not yet thinking about achieving herd immunity. What we're trying to do is risk mitigation, right? That is to say, we are looking to achieve a population level benefit in terms of reducing the severe disease and mortality due to COVID-19 by focusing on the individuals for whom those outcomes are most likely, i.e. the elderly and those with high risk conditions. And so the early impact of this rollout will maybe not be reflected quite so much in a drop in the number of total cases that we're seeing, because transmission may still continue in the general population. But what I hope for and expect to see, actually, is that we'll see a significant drop in mortality.
Dr. Boucher, in our last minute or so, let's talk once more with feeling, as they would say, about safety, especially now that we're seeing in the UK, authorities are now recommending that those with a history of allergic reactions not get the shot. So let's just review. Are we anticipating that it will be safe and safe for the majority of people?
Well, so far, based on what we know, Tiziana, it looks like the vaccine is safe. And it's important to remind everybody that there have been layers of safety in this development process. Data Safety Monitoring Committee reviewed the study. The FDA reviewed the data and analyzed it themselves. Their external advisory committee meeting is meeting tomorrow, and you can watch it on live stream. And then the CDC and their advisory committee are reviewing it. So layers and layers of safety, much more so than we ever see for a drug. Vaccines are, you know, regulated in a much more rigorous fashion. So I think that we can trust the recommendations that come out of that process.
You know, since almost the very beginning of the pandemic, we have known that older adults are particularly vulnerable to COVID-19. That's why Governor Baker has included residents of long-term care and assisted living facilities and adults over the age of 65 in the first two phases of vaccine distribution. But we're a long way, as the governor has said, from being out of the woods. So how do older adults balance living out some of their best years while staying safe? And how do families and loved ones continue to help care for them, love them, and stay in contact, especially through the holidays, when we still have to be apart? That's what we want to talk about. We invite your experiences, whether you are an older adult living through this or a friend or family member trying to figure it out. Again, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or on Twitter, it's at Radio Boston. We have two great guests for this conversation. Both work with older adults and their families on a regular basis. We have Lou Wolf, who is president and CEO of Hebrew Senior Life, and Emily Shea, who is the head of the Boston Age Strong Commission. Lou and Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
There can be a misperception that older adults are at home anyway, retired, maybe not as active. Help us understand the realities and nuances of older adult life and how that has been changed by the coronavirus. Lou, let's start with you.
So, no question, it's changed dramatically for older adults. We as an organization take care of about 2,500 older adults on a daily basis in our different communities and another 500 or so in their homes. And we've always been an organization that focused not only on the quality of care for our older adults and safety, but also their quality of life, and focused a lot of attention on them having vital lives and very active and a lot of socialization and keeping their minds and bodies active and setting new goals. So when the pandemic started in the spring, we were very proactive in quarantining people and keeping them as safe as possible, but at one point had over 200 combination of volunteers and employees who were focusing all of their attention on keeping people active, doing virtual events, bringing people food and opening people's mail and bringing them. So we have worked very hard to keep our residents and our patients as engaged and active as possible. But there's no question that it is very different than it was previously. And and that's not good for older adults. It's very important that they be as active and engaged as possible.
And Emily, as a broader community, what should our top collective priority be in supporting our older adults right now?
Sure. So, I mean, my office as Boston's Council on Aging at the City of Boston works with a broad range of older adults. So first of all, we have to recognize it's a very diverse population. If you're thinking about people from age 60 to folks that are over 100 years old. And so, but some of the themes that we've seen come up that we really have been thinking about and trying to make sure that we're supporting people around are themes like social isolation, right? We've seen for people that have chosen to stay inside because of all of the health risks for going out, we've seen increases in confusion and dementia. We've seen folks lose muscle mass and have more likelihood of falls. So, and we've also seen people get more and more depressed because they're connecting with less people. As Lou said, that kind of connection and staying active is just so important. So we would really encourage people to reach out to folks in their lives that they think might be more isolated and make those connections. We've also seen a lot of people reaching out around food access and kind of basic needs, the ability to pay for the things that that they need to live, things like heat, like rent, like food, getting their medications. And so my office has been doing a lot of work around those issues as well to help people get the supports that they need.
We've got calls coming in, so let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line from Millis. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd rather not divulge my age, but I can say when I was 1 day old, my mother held me up to the phone, I mean to the radio, to hear the Germans surrender in World War II. So you can do the math. At any
later.
Rate, I really am worried for the first time in my life about whether I'm going to make it to 100. And I'm in great shape. I hike 3.5 miles every single day. I meditate for more than an hour every single day. I eat a good diet. And yet, I have to say that this started when my wife, against her will, had to spend 2 months working with on a COVID floor with morbidly obese people who she was having to turn. And that meant that I had to be quarantined for 2 entire months. And ever since then, I've actually had to change my work because fortunately I have the option of working from home. But that adds a whole new set of stresses. And I think it is really a tremendous challenge at this point. Now, I think more than anything
else. David?
Yep.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to give our guests a chance to react to what you've already said, because there's a lot there that I think will also apply to other people who are listening. So thanks for that call. And Lou, I'm going to turn to you. My guess is that what we're hearing from David, you hear from people.
Oh, absolutely. And the first thing I want to say to David is touche for you, given you the age that you implied and the fact that you're doing everything you're doing. You're
That's
certainly
right.
doing everything you can to increase the chances of living to 100. There's no question that people are worried. I think it's also good that David is worried because it shows that he's taking this extremely seriously. The fact that there is a vaccine available now is, on one hand, great news. We are all very excited about it. We believe very much in the science and the seriousness that people are taking. And we do feel people should be very encouraged by that. But at the same time, people still have to stay vigilant as far as everything that they know, as far as masks and all. But I think that if people are vigilant and they are careful and they care for themselves the way David talked about it, there's no reason why this should increase the chances of David not living to 100.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Emily, over the months, we have been covering this pandemic with every breath, it seems, since probably mid-February. And one of the things we've worried about all along is social-emotional well-being of everyone in our greater Boston community, everyone in the Commonwealth. How do we zero in on what the social-emotional concerns and needs are of older adults who might be living in any of a variety of home situations, whether isolated in a home or in congregant living or in assisted living? How should we be thinking about that, and what are you focused on?
Sure. Well, I mean, Mayor Walsh really tasked us to start thinking about the social isolation and what my office could do to help to reduce how isolated people are. So we've been doing a whole host of things. First of all, we're putting out calls to older adults in Boston just to check in with them. We have called close to 50,000 people so far. We also set up a call center in my office so that we can be available for when folks are calling in, because sometimes people just need to talk to somebody and we want to make sure that we're there for them. And I think, you know, you hear Lou talking about what they're doing at Hebrew Senior Life. We have aging partners, aging services partners across the city who are doing similar things, really just making sure that we're here for people, that people have someone to talk to, and people have someone to connect with. And then I think that other piece is really making sure that there's opportunities for people to engage and connect. So making sure that the events that we used to do in person, we're now doing virtually online. We know that a lot of people don't have tech access, so we're working on a program to help with that. But we're also making sure that there's opportunities for people to connect over the phone, for people to connect by watching cable TV and listening to interesting programs there that we can put up. So really making sure that people have those opportunities for connection, because our last caller was correct. You know, we are in a very different time, and people are having to change what they typically do to keep themselves healthy. And I think the things we have to remember are that there are to take care of ourselves, right? To take the time, like he was meditating, take the time to rejuvenate, mm-hmm. take the time to practice wellness techniques with yourself and reduce your stress, and also take the time to connect with others, because that piece is really important.
Are you an older adult like our caller David, who is thriving, but maybe for the first time, a little worried, a little afraid? Or maybe you're a family member who cannot be with and connect with and support an older adult that you love the way you want to? Call us and tell us about it. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lou, Emily talked in part there about support for people learning how to use technology. I want to play a little sound for you. This is Mike Ross, who is a resident at Newbridge on the Charles, which is one of the Hebrew Senior Life senior living communities, talking about some of the way life has changed for him. Here he is.
Well, what would have been typical would be that we would probably have been eating in one of our two dining rooms with either two more or four more of our friends. We can't do that. So we're having dinner at home tonight by ourselves. You know, that's just one little example of how things are different. Now, not everybody here can use a computer. We've got people who are older than the computer generation, if you will.
And yet, Lou, Zoom has become a verb. So what kinds of challenges does that create for some of our older adults, and what can we do about it?
Well, there's no question, you know, Mike and his wife, Benita, are great residents at Newbridge, and they are fortunate that they have each other. There are many people who don't. And we have a very active IT department as well, so we do as much as we can to reach out to our residents to help them with their technology. So certainly on our campuses, we optimize the use of technology. We have regular Zoom meetings with all of our residents, and the residents themselves do that. But, you know, Emily is right. For people who aren't as IT capable, just using the phone more, reaching out, family members, doing FaceTime and all, whatever you can do to connect. There's nothing wrong with people just relying on the telephone and speaking, and particularly of that generation, they are very comfortable with the phone, and it feels very, you know, intimate to them. But it you know, it is something that, you're absolutely right, Zoom is extraordinary, and it's been a big help for this population. It's not quite as easy. It's actually thinking back to David and the fact that he spends 3.5 hours hiking and a great diet and meditating. You know, he didn't mention the whole connection and socialization. And I hope that everyone listening does pay attention to, you know, what Emily talked about the importance of connecting with people. And, you know, Zoom is great, but and it's getting colder as far as doing, you know, outside socialization. But that it is a really, really important thing for people to focus on and value.
Let's hear from one more caller here. We've got Carol on the line from Melrose. Carol, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Carol. I live in Melrose. I do echo the fact that keeping in touch with people is very important. Phone calls, letters. I happen to live in a building, an apartment for seniors. We do see people as we, you know, dump our trash, get our meal, going in and out. And there are some services provided to try to keep everybody in touch. But it is a difficult time. Some people have email, but even a phone call or, you know, letters, whatever, does a big thing. And, of course, those of us like myself who has a cat, that's wonderful companionship. And I'm
Carol,
glad
thanks.
You're bringing this up on your program. Keep up the good work. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Carolyn. Thank you for listening. You know, a minute or so to go, Emily. I wasn't expecting to talk about this, but hearing Carol talk about having a pet, that kind of companionship, you know, running a program in the city of Boston, are you hearing about the need for furry companionship for people who might be isolated now?
So, I mean, I think that pets for people that have them are really comforting and obviously a good connection for people. And so I think I think there's a menu of options for people who are socially isolated and want to connect. One other thing that we've done in the city is we've been able to make additional investments with some partner agencies like Friendship Works, Little Brothers Friends of the Elderly, and Nesterly. They have been connecting volunteers with older adults so that they can provide that one-on-one companionship over the phone and on a regular companionship. So I just think that the opportunities are there for people, and I invite folks to reach out if you're having trouble figuring out how to connect. Certainly if you live in Boston,
Emily,
you can
Sorry. Yes,
that's
great.
Right.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
We're out of time. Emily Shea from the city of Boston, Lou Wolf from Hebrew Senior Life. Thanks to both of you.